Raphael Weinroth Brown is an internationally renowned Canadian cellist, multi-instrumentalist, and composer. He merges his classical cello training with a love of progressive metal and Middle Eastern music, and has formed several acclaimed ensembles, including The Visit, Musk Ox, and Comanchello. This duo was a previous guest of this podcast, Comanche player Shahryar Jamshidi. Raphael has been touring with the Norwegian progressive band Leprous since 2017 and has appeared on over 150 studio albums. In 2020, he released his first solo album, Worlds Within. Raph is a very thoughtful and articulate person, and this conversation touched on many interesting topics. In part one, you'll get to hear him demonstrate and talk about the first part of Worlds Within, and hear about his career as a studio musician and his experiences touring with Leprous. He shares his thoughts about knowing yourself, being creative, connecting with your audience, and balancing your life and expectations of yourself. Part two of this episode is the next release in this podcast and video series, and everything is linked in the description. Timestamps are included in the description.
Hey, Raphael Weinroth Brown, thanks for joining me.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I meant to ask you, I know a lot of people call you Raph. Is that okay?
Or of course, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Okay, I like to go by Raphael. Okay. You know, your recent solo album, Worlds Within, the first version, you wrote pre-pandemic, I realized.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, so I was thinking about that because your fans, you know, people ascribe meaning, and I've talked about this with other of my guests, they'll be like, oh, this is about, in this case, maybe they think, feel like it's about the isolation of the pandemic or whatever meaning they have, especially since there's no words. Mm. But, you know, I was thinking about that. And then, you know, you redid it as the live version, which is different, but I really enjoyed that. I was just thinking about that off the bat, you know, how we're we're still sitting in this pandemic, but it's better than it was sure 2.5 years ago.
Definitely.
So can you talk about what that was like for you when well, if you want to just talk about the album first.
Yeah, well, the album kind of had its initial seeds in, I would say, as early as 2017. Mm-hmm. And I was really just experimenting with ideas at that point, and I didn't really know what they were going to turn into, but I was interested in the material that I was creating. There was sort of like a set of ideas in a certain cello tuning. It was like an alternate tuning, and it was kind of a bit reminiscent of David Darling, who I'm a big fan of, and he's a big influence on my cello playing or composing style, I guess. And so there was this sort of suite of ideas, and they weren't really connected at that point, but I thought they were all interesting and they were evocative, and so I wanted to explore that more, and I wasn't sure what the form would be, you know, the way that they would all sort of be chained together. But initially, I thought, okay, it'll be like a long piece, maybe like a variation set with like these short kind of movements. And then every time that I kind of dove back into the material to try and sort of finalize parts, these new branches would grow and these new kind of variations would emerge based on the original core idea. So it's very much in that way like a variation set, passacaglia, whatever, this type of thing. It uses the same harmonic bass, but then each iteration is a little bit different and it's kind of got its own personality. And so I guess it was probably towards summer 2018, I kind of had this collection of voice memos on my phone of these different looped improvisations. And so I was really just kind of going for it off the cuff and kind of composing in real time and just capturing the sort of spontaneous spirit of that and then just kind of storing it for later. And I had a sense at that point that it would be an album and that there would be these, you know, multiple movements and that there would be these bookends, unending one and two, which is kind of like the same piece but with a different I guess the bass line is different, but the rest of the material is quite similar, and the form is quite similar. So those were kind of the sort of the A and B parts on either end of it. And then I basically just spent a bunch of time trying to figure out how the other parts would flow together. And it was just sort of like this thing that I uncovered more than anything, sort of made sense to me over time. And I had been touring a lot in 2018 with Leprous. And so at the end of that year, I really wanted to get back to working on some of my own stuff and get something down, because I knew I was away so much. I really wanted to capture that. And so I booked the studio for a few consecutive days. It was like December, you know, after I had been on tour like almost the entire fall. And so I just went in there and basically started laying down the bed tracks of what was going to be Worlds Within. And I didn't go in with a completely fleshed out idea, you know, with all of the parts 100% worked out, which one could do, right? You know, you could score it out and kind of really demo all the details. But there were even parts that I was coming up with really just a couple of weeks before going into the studio, like these new things that were emerging. And I was kind of allowing it to be something really fresh and open-ended. And I think that's also, that was part of what made it interesting, was that I was approaching it from a place of spontaneity and still feeling like I was in the spirit of that music and that it was exciting to me and not something that I just had rehearsed to death and that I had to record. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how it started. And then basically over the course of 2019, very sporadically, I went to the studio and gradually completed bits and pieces. And, you know, there were certain things that I worked out more after the bed tracks had been recorded. Like there's a lot of solos and kind of melodic lines that weren't part of the original composition that I thought would kind of tie the whole thing together and create this sort of narrating voice. So that it wasn't just like this architecture of loops and little bits and pieces and just motifs all the time, but also that there was something more overarching that would tell the story and kind of link all the parts together. So I guess in terms of the composition of the original album, that would be it in a nutshell. And I think that it all came out very intuitively in a way. And then afterwards, I was kind of discovering what it was a little bit. You know, sometimes when you complete something and you stand back from it, you realize what it is. And it was very much that way for me, which actually made it more fascinating to delve back into it as a live record and to play it live a lot. Actually, I remember my first time performing the work live, which was the CD release at the NAC Fourth Stage in 2020, like January 2020. And it was kind of a trip. I realized, whoa, okay, I really like playing this. And I've never played anything that quite satisfied me in this way. And so then it just sort of made me excited to keep performing the material. And it's really kind of evolved ever since. And I haven't gotten too tired of it yet.
Yeah. So you record in that, there's a studio in Luskville. There's a big barn. Is that the place?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically just a barn. And we brought some gear in. It's my friend Dean Watson, who's a Ottawa-based producer and engineer. And we've worked together for probably, 14 years now on various projects. And so basically, he had actually a flood in his basement in 2019. But he had a friend who was living in Luskville who had this, you know, space on his property, basically. And so and he had mentioned to me, oh, you know, we might be able to use this kind of building to record in. And I thought, yeah, why don't we do it? You know, it's got like, you know, wood paneling and high ceilings. And we had all these projects we needed to work on. There were a lot of deadlines. So actually part of Worlds Within was done there, just sort of a few bits and pieces here and there, some overdubs and some solos. But of course, the entire live record was, you know, shot and recorded in that space, along with a lot of other things. Actually, during the pandemic, mm-hmm. it was a really good thing to have during that period, you know, in the lockdowns and stuff when we couldn't use like rehearsal studios mm-hmm. even. There are all these rules about just going into a facility and making anything. So I was able to go in there with my guys, with Dean and Andrew, who was doing the videos, and basically just complete that whole project during the lockdown period and make something of it.
Yeah, something beautiful. Your videos are very beautiful to
you.
Yeah, and you have really, you know, high production values, and it seems something you really value that you've put something into.
Definitely.
Yeah, I don't know if a lot of young artists definitely do that unless it's provided to them. They don't go out of their way to make that happen.
depends, I think, on the artist, and it depends on the scene that you're part of too. Like, I think sort of the scene that I'm in, I think, is very aesthetically driven. Mm-hmm. Like, I think album covers are really important too. You know, it, I think like prog and metal bands, you see the type of artwork, and it really usually, I would say, really enhances the actual audio, you know, the disc itself or whatever. So when you get the package, if you're getting a vinyl or what have you, then it's like this extra thing, you know, you got like the gold foil text and like the nice inlays and everything. So yeah, to me, the visual aesthetics are really important, because I also have a lot of visual associations that come to mind from the music. Mm-hmm. And I think that like you can play great and you can even look really cool when you play, but it's like if you don't have someone able to capture that with the right eye and also to be able to move with you, mm-hmm. then it doesn't capture the energy, which I think is super important, because a video should entice people to want to see that artist live. And I think that sort of the live stage is still like this place where the old traditions still exist, you know, where like the technology has disrupted music in so many different ways and the way we consume it and, you know, the degree that we relate to it. But people still, you know, get the goosebumps and get blown away at a live show in the same way that they always have, I think. And I think that a show can really change one's perspective on an artist or really open them up to what that artist can offer. So it's very important to, I think, get people interested in that. And now actually we use the internet and these kind of little tidbits to make people interested in seeing shows and kind of committing to that real-time experience. But yeah, the videos have always been important, and they've always been a way for me to kind of disseminate my material and like anything that I've composed to make it accessible to people very easily and to show it in proper quality. I think that like because of the age that I am, that I got into YouTube at a time where like it was kind of more fashionable to make high quality music videos. Mm-hmm. And I got into it like pretty early. But you know, now, for example, I'd say the last couple of years, YouTube has really taken this turn towards like content creation and vlogging, and music is more like a thing that's attached to the video as opposed to being the thing itself that you would present. And so the type of stuff that I've done, you know, over the last few years in music videos is a little bit like a dinosaur now. And I think the move in music is more towards like raw content. So, you know, things that are kind of taken on cell phones and stuff like that. And in the past, I would have never allowed myself to just post those things. But now I realize that the attention economy is very different than it was in, let's say, 2013. And so it's good actually to just kind of show these real life scenarios a little bit. And then that gives people, it sort of builds up their commitment to like a 10-minute staged music video with like, you know, drones and all the, you know, bells and whistles that come along with it. So, yeah, like I think we're always shifting and adapting, but I love doing those videos and I would totally do more of them if I had the sort of the time. To come back to what you were saying, I thought it was interesting what you were saying about funding. I think that like funding is a big factor in Canada, that'll, pardon the pun, the factor that like people kind of expect that if they're going to do a big project that they need funding. And I've always had more of an attitude of, well, I'm just going to use my own hard-earned money and just pay for the video, even if it's going to cost me a lot of money, because I don't want to be dependent on the funding. I appreciate that we have it here in this country and that it's not just a purely sort of capitalistic scenario. But I think that funding is also a thing that's like the times, you know, with social media and the internet. It's like things go in and out of fashion and the types of things that get funding change over time. But quality is always the same. If you make something of quality, it's kind of timeless. And so you should make it regardless of whether it's in fashion or not. You should just make it. And so I don't want to be dependent on whether I feel that what I do is relevant in the cultural landscape in Canada now. That doesn't matter to me. it's I'm gonna do the same thing I've been doing over the last 10 years, like in 20 years, hopefully. And yeah, so I just kind of want to be immutable in that regard and not be affected in any way by what's happening around me here and what's available, I guess, in terms of those external resources.
You've brought up so many different points. I'd like to go off on these tangents, but so one thing I was thinking about, you mentioned the album art, because your duo with Heather Cedar Black, your The Visit, she did the album art, right? She's also an artist.
Yeah, so she did the album art for Worlds Within, that's right. And that's really like an integral component of that record and, yeah, sort of the visual world, the whole concept, I think. And actually, those paintings were completed before the album was. So I was working on the record and then I was just looking at the paintings and I just thought, that's the album cover. I need that. And of course, there's two of them and they're kind of similar. They're these resin paintings and it's kind of like an aleatoric style. Like you're sort of pouring the resin on the canvas and then sort of stirring it and it kind of comes out in its own way, like in a very natural sort of flow. And yeah, you can just keep looking at them forever. So, you know, I just thought, okay, this kind of oceanic elemental vibe is exactly the right thing for this music, which, yeah, I think has a very circular trajectory. It's not like a linear path, you know, where it, some pieces, there's this feeling of, you know, having to go through this linear journey and then it's like, okay, we've conquered C minor, you know, or whatever. And like, there's a big cadence at the end and it's like final, you know, or there's this feeling of, yeah, having sort of slain the beast. And with this record, it doesn't do that at all. Like it doesn't really try to show off in any way. It, you know, there's some kind of dramatic moments in the middle, but it's more like this completely circular journey. And so in that way, I think that the artwork is perfect for it because they both have that kind of, it's sort of indirect. It doesn't really come at you saying something specific or making you feel like you have to understand it from one angle. It just sort of invites you in to interpret it the way it might be and the way you want it to be. And then the live album also has one of her paintings, which is again similar. And I just thought, okay, I knew the one and I was like, this is going to be right, you know, as a sort of companion record. I need to have something again that's like complementary to the first so that they can exist together as this kind of like a little box set or whatever, you know, that it's expanding on that universe and not completely departing from it. And as I've kind of done various things to spin out the record and find new ways to sort of reinvent it and sort of manage the, I guess, the promotional campaign also, I've just felt like, yeah, it's actually this universe and, you know, the Worlds Within. It's like, it's a kind of a world building, you know, maybe soft world building, like, because you don't know the entire backstory, like Lord of the Rings, you don't have all the appendices or whatever, like... you kind of know the general story, but then there's a lot of things on the periphery that are vague and it's up to you to interpret them, but you get these different angles and you get to go back into that universe, you know, with the live album. And I'm probably going to do one other kind of spin-off project of it, before I decide it's enough. But you know, people like that too. I think people like sequels and prequels and like spin-off series and things like that. If they really like a story, then they'll get into it. And I think that's totally okay, you know, if the content you're delivering is good. And I think like it's not just repeating the same old ground, but like giving something new as well, then I think it's welcome. Okay, so I mean, I guess since we have the call running and we could talk a little bit about this tuning that I'm using here. And of course I was just kind of tuning again because this morning I was in standard equal temperament for some recording I was doing, this is an open tuning that I guess I came up with for Worlds Within, but I didn't really do it specifically for that. I had been toying with it for a while, and it's, I mean, just the standard A, G, then F, B flat. So, of course, we see like a B, F sharp, D, A tuning sometimes in cello music, not particularly often, but it's a bit more known. But this is kind of like, it's sort of like an extension of D minor, I guess you could say, because, you know, you're still within the same key, so you're really mostly operating within that sort of modality. But I also see it kind of as like a B flat Lydian tuning. And so I think one of the first things that came out for the Worlds Within material, for example, was this layered harmonic idea. So So that's Unending One, of course, from Worlds Within Us, the first part of the album. Can you hear me okay when I'm talking?
I can, yeah. Although sometimes when you're playing and talking, it was a little hard, so we may not... yeah, I would avoid that, but beautiful. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. So yeah, just to maybe recap some of that. So I was just trying to explain a little bit of what's happening at different points in the music. So basically there's like a loop of harmonics, and then... But the harmonics don't really indicate what the chords are going to be. And what I like to do with looping is to kind of create that ambiguity where it starts off with something and you're not really sure where the floor is. It's like you know, in a film, for example, where it's like really zoomed in on something and it starts to pan out and then you understand mm-hmm. where you are, but you don't right away. It kind of leaves room for the piece to develop some added interest, particularly when you have a thing like this, which is repeating for so long. It doesn't feel so much like it's just repeating forever. So there's the harmonics that are looping that are creating this kind of like ethereal texture. But then there's another set of harmonics that loop also. And so when the first set fades away, then you have this lighter version of the same thing. Kind of a version of the beginning also. And that kind of gives it like a sort of a more sparse texture to end on. And the solos were improvised in the beginning on the record, like as everything was completely improvised and then we just picked what we liked. But then I think over time, you know, when you get used to the record, then you start playing it that way. And then so on the live album, then it's kind of got its own version, and now I pretty much just play it like the live album. Mm-hmm. So it's not really improvised anymore. At the end, this kind of like this... I kind of want to have this crossroads sort of scenario where all of a sudden now we're just sort of sitting on this drone, and then we have these questions that are asked, you know? Towards whatever comes next.
Yeah, I was thinking about so many things. One of them was in terms of finding a new audience, and you talked about promotion, and it's all about connection. And you talked briefly about the new content on social media, which is these very casual, you know, which I hated at the beginning, and now I've come around to like, I get it. But I think it's about it's making those connections with audiences that they feel like they know you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why it works.
100%. Yeah, I was the same initially. I think I was really allergic to the idea of posting something also that was kind of raw. And, you know, it needed to be the finished mm-hmm. product. And so then I would take a lot of time and I would justify that I was taking the time that I needed to make that thing. But the issue is that, again, I use the word attention, the term attention economy. Like, the thing is that our attention is getting fragmented into these like smaller and smaller slivers, and it's being done by powers that are much bigger than we are as individuals. So, while we also have more power in a way, like more autonomy to get the art out there and to reach people easily, it's also there's more people doing that than ever. So it's more about standing out and so it's like you have to develop a level of investment in the person and their story before then the audience feels that they're prepared to commit to the actual mm-hmm. art, and that like they can go and kind of sit down and watch the music video or buy the album or go to the show or whatever. It's like that's a much higher level of commitment, and you can't go there cold, you know what I mean? You have to warm them up to it a little bit. And I'm cool with that. And one thing I have to say is that posting stuff from my shows, for example, like short clips or, you know, during 2020 and 2021, I made a lot of just phone videos from home. And, you know, of course, those are a bit more curated in the sense that, like, I could do other takes of things if I wasn't satisfied. But more and more, I've just learned to embrace things not being perfect or not being exactly the way I would like to have them. And I think it's been really healthy. And actually, I feel like using social media to share my music has been a really good exercise in, like, not being so precious about everything and focusing more on consistency and showing up and doing the thing rather than getting cold feet and not doing it because I'm worried that it's not 100% or whatever. And I think that's just good in life in general. Like, are you going to not show up because you're worried that you won't impress yourself enough? It's like, you're not going to do as well, I think, in the long term by deciding to retreat and not show up because you thought, well, you know, I'm scared that I'm not going to deliver, or I'm not ready today, or whatever. It's like, it's more about doing it even when you're not ready, because most of the time when you have a big opportunity, the conditions are not always good. And it's like, but you still have to do your best, even though no one knows that you're feeling at your worst, potentially. And so it's just a good exercise, like, in the day-to-day, you know, showing up in doing your thing and putting yourself out there. And I think that, again, it's sort of like if you had a store, you know, if you have, like, a small business and, you know, you're only open, like, part of the time, maybe a couple of days a week, that's not so good. You got to be open, like, maybe 6 days a week or 7 days a week. And so that's kind of how I see it. It's like I show up and I go to work, you know, and that's what it is, really. But just, yeah, it's been a process more recently of sort of embracing the imperfection and just being more gentle with myself and just going, you know, it's like a lot of people are not bothered by that because they're not really there to look for all those things. I mean, they might notice some things, but they're more like there for the overall energy and the commitment to the offering that is the music and the heart that you put into it and the energy that you bring. That's like, that far outweighs, I think, small technical details and things that might be different from the sort of Ur version from the record or the score or whatever it is. It's just, yeah, I'm focusing more on that, understanding that, like, the value that we each bring to performance has much more to do with the energy and the commitment to creating that moment and being fully there for it and like feeling through the music. And yeah, you know, I think that's much more important, really. And playing live after having had a break from doing it really brought me back to that, thinking, okay, we get a second chance to do this. Like, and, you know, I don't want to feel like I came back and, you know, did these shows and wasn't really committed to that moment, that I was, you know, just sort of on autopilot. Like, and so in a way it was a good reminder to come back to that and understand what live performance is really about in that way. And I think in that sense, I also feel that in the last year, I've definitely had even a greater commitment to the energy that I bring to the stage than maybe I did before.
I feel the same way, actually. I'm curious, at the very beginning of the pandemic, did you actually stop playing for a while, or did you keep taking your cello out every day or other instruments?
That's a great question. Well, you know, I had been pretty busy. Like, so I got back to Canada from a 3-week tour in Europe and the Middle East. And, like, it was in February 2020. And, like, countries were closing down. And then we were, like, leaving them, and then things were getting shut down and events were getting canceled. And so I got off of that and I arrived in Canada and people were a little bit scared. And then I had some more shows. And I think it was just a few days later that, you know, they announced, I remember it was March 13th. They announced, okay, it's a global pandemic. And so it was kind of like, okay, I guess everything's canceled for now. And I think at first, yeah, the first 2 weeks, I took a break from cello, I played bass guitar every day, and I played electric guitar every day, And I just experimented and just practiced and used pedals and tried stuff. And so I would say I was creative, but I just, you know, because I had been playing cello on tour and doing these shows, I thought, let's just, I don't know, like, I don't need to use this for a little bit. Like, let's just do something different because I could. And normally I don't get the time to play other instruments. I, you know, it's like, I have so much cello related work I have to do that people are expecting me to do that I have to just stay on it. And then even then, sometimes playing your instrument just to practice is a little bit of a scarcity because you're dealing with so much other like logistics and emails and internet and all those sorts of things. So yeah, at the beginning I kind of slowed it down a bit, but then pretty quickly I wanted to play again. But yeah, that's a good question, because I think that a lot of people maybe felt that their motivation to practice was called into question a little bit, where, you know, when you always have a thing to work towards, if you have a performance, then it kind of always keeps you in shape. Or if you have a social mm-hmm. event, actually, where it's like you have to be there around other people and you have to have your chops up, then of course it's you know, a social pressure is like very strong for humans. So like naturally, you know, we feel that like we should show up and kind of be put together. Whereas when you don't need to be around people, it's kind of like, yeah. And I think that was the case for a lot of people. But I would say, yeah, I also dropped Worlds Within for a little bit. Like I kind of put it to sleep for a little while. I kind of felt like at the beginning of the pandemic that it was almost inappropriate to talk about certain things. It was like very serious, and the mood was kind of like, you know, we didn't really want to bother anybody about anything. Or some people reached out to me right away and said, oh, let's work on a project, like, and I had kind of no interest, actually. I didn't really take offers. I just sort of let them slide. The first 3 months I kind of felt like mm-hmm. I was retired. Like I worked on a few things, but in general, like, it was pretty chill. I was doing more creative work, kind of exploring more. And then I think by July, things started to really move again. And I started doing like live streams and some actual outdoor shows. And then I got really busy with session work. People started asking me to do session work, and I got set up from home and kind of just jumped right off the deep end and started doing that all the time. And I had never used a digital audio workstation before. So I'd watched people do it a lot, but I had to learn all of that mm-hmm. as I went along. And so that's kind of how it went for me, I guess.
I know you did over 40 sessions, like different studio recordings in 2021. And it strikes me you're quite young, like you were really well established as a studio musician internationally at such a young age, because you started in your teens to do that kind of work.
Yeah. Yeah, it was sort of, I think, the byproduct of working on my own music and trying mm-hmm. to record it as a teenager that I ended up being in studios and meeting engineers and meeting other musicians. And then, you know, if you have something that's sort of maybe a bit unique, or they are interested in the project you're doing, then they might ask mm-hmm. you to play on their record. And again, speaking about Dean Watson, you know, he was sort of a big help for me in the early days, especially because he's very well connected here. And so by knowing him and working with him, I got to meet a lot of people automatically. And so that was extremely helpful. And yeah, so I think it started off as more of a local thing. Like I was playing in the evenings, you know, in university, you know, after classes and stuff, I'd play gigs, and then I would meet people, and then they would ask me to play on their records. And I started kind of getting known in Ottawa, you know, I guess in my like late teens, early 20s. And then I moved to Toronto and I started getting busy there. But the other thing is the projects that I was working on, like Muskox, for example, you know, which we've had as a group for a long time, has always had an international reputation. And my other projects too, The Visit and my solo stuff and Camoncello, like it's all been kind of maybe received a bit more abroad, actually. And so that all kind of came back. But actually the pandemic is where it really became much more international and less local or national. And I think that's just, It's funny because we've always had the ability to record remotely. I mean, for many years, right? We've had the technology, but people didn't do it as much. And I think, especially the last couple of years, people realized, well, I could work with anybody in the world, really, as long as they have a home set up. It's not even about being in a proper studio anymore. It's just about getting things done and working with the right people, I guess. And so then I started getting a lot more offers from people in different countries, and it was kind of cool to see how they would operate. And yeah, it's been like a really wide range, as it often is, but I don't really specialize in a style. I just do me, and people ask me to do something, and I sort of try to cater to that, you know. So yeah, it kind of changed a lot in that way. And certainly last year was an insanely busy year for recording, which I think was good. But now I'm kind of ready to not do that so much. There was just, yeah, so many projects. They were really cool, like some really great music, a lot of it that hasn't been released, a lot of really challenging music too, you know, that required a lot of time and attention to detail. And I think it's like anything, when you go into that level of specialization with it, eventually you get to a point where you feel that maybe you've kind of said what you needed to say with it. And that if you continue kind of forever at that pace, that you're just really repeating yourself. You're not necessarily doing something new. And so for me, there actually is an artistic need to do things that I feel will fulfill me in new ways. You know, because if I'm working on projects like that all the time, then sometimes there's a feeling of, oh, I've done another thing like this, you know, in the past. And it becomes less exciting. And it's nice to have that feeling for not just to be work.
It's interesting. I listened to so many of your recordings and collaborations with other people. And you said you do you, and you definitely have a voice. But describing your music, I mean, labels really bother me. And, you know, how would I even describe you? I would just say like, you know, a multi-genre, and I would call you a multi-instrumentalist, even though you're known best as a cellist, because you play, as you mentioned, you know, bass guitar, piano, oud, flamenco guitar.
I've done all those things over the years.
Yeah.
Drums, like, yeah, so a lot of stuff. And I mean, that kind of comes more from, I guess, being someone who writes music, and you think, well, okay, you know, I'll just sort of write on this instrument, or you know, you envision a texture with these instruments, and then you just decide, okay, maybe I'll just play them or something. But thinking about the kind of the bigger picture and how each component works, and then trying to get a bit more hands-on with it. And I think that I just also know how I like things to be played when I've written them. So then sometimes I'll just naturally kind of pick it up and figure out the feel that it needs. Even if I'm not the most specialized on that instrument, I know what's sort of required to get it to fit in with the whole. So yeah, it's just something that I think comes from composing. And there's also kind of, it's funny because there's also a danger that when you work on things and your microscope is on really high, trying to nail specific parts, and you're trying to really like perfect that one aspect of the music, that then you kind of get sucked out from that, because then you're on the opposite end of the spectrum. So I try to balance those things out, where on one hand, like a lot of the session work I do, it's really like you're one component of a bigger thing often, but then also the way you build whatever your part is has to be done meticulously, and you're almost like a horse in blinders. You're not paying attention to everything else. And then it works. But also, there's times when you really need to zoom out and not listen to any one thing, but just get the overall impression. And I find more and more that when I listen to artists in a live setting, and when I'm just sort of taking something in for the first time, I kind of want it to be that way. I just want to take it in as music and not, you know, be so focused on these tiny details, because they should all serve the bigger thing, really. And when you're kind of nerding out on stuff and you're trying to make your music really cool, sometimes you can get lost in those details too and forget, okay, well, what is this saying in general? And for someone who doesn't know about all that stuff and maybe can't appreciate it on the same level, will it still say that for them? And then for other people who sort of want to look in greater detail, can they, you know, enjoy, again, the whole and also the individual parts, you know, if they want to? It's like not everyone's going to want to know those inner workings, and that's okay, but they're there serving a purpose, whether you notice them or not, mm-hmm. ideally, you know? So I think about that more and more in terms of a composition and how it comes mm-hmm. across, I guess.
You know, I'd love to see in the future yourself or somebody write a concerto for you with orchestra, you know, kind of like hybrid. I recently interviewed mm-hmm. Tracy Silverman, who has had such an interesting career, and he's like did a lot of rock and different styles and jazz and, you know, a multi-genre player who came out of this classical background. And he has had a bunch of concertos written for him and his electric violin, and then he's written some. And what's interesting is then he does a solo version with looping of the concerto by various people, which is, yeah. And I was thinking,
really cool.
I mean, you guys are different, but I, you know, similar in some ways. And I was also curious because I know you play on a Schreyer, a beautiful acoustic cello mostly. Do you play electric cello at all? Like a five string at all?
I've thought about an extended range instrument for sure. You know, I haven't tried, like physically played an electric cello that I really liked, that I thought was superior in sound. And yeah, the Schreyer mm-hmm. cello with the pickup that I have and then the effects, like it just sounds good. It has a lot of body to it and it doesn't lose any of that kind of, I think, the complexity of the sound mm-hmm. and the low end and that sort of thing. So I think because it's such a workhorse, actually, even for like a fine handmade instrument, it's like a workhorse in all these scenarios. So I've just used it on everything and I've just retuned it and stuff. But I would really like to, try either some type of electric, five string, or, you know, I was even thinking like it'd be cool to have like a piccolo cello, but like, you know, with a pickup, either like a retrofitted thing or something that's like customized. Because it would just be cool to play with that extra like tessitura, you know what I mean? Like to have, you know, the extra string. And for me, that whole concept of like invention that you see in Bach and like all of these composers that wrote for the unaccompanied string instruments, that stuff is just, you know what I mean? I just can't get enough of it. Like it's just so tasty, you know, when it's done right. And using a lot of open strings and harmonics and making the instrument really work for you. Like I would totally be excited to try to do something like that with an extended range instrument. I've just never really had the opportunity. But yeah, I've thought a little bit about that and what you could do, for example, if you had like a high E string, but then you were still tuning the low strings down a little bit. So then you would widen even more, you know what I mean? That would be pretty cool. So yeah, it's just a question of, I guess, getting access to those things because I feel like they're not standard. And this is something that like is a bit weird to me in bowed string playing is that there's a lot of people out there doing really interesting things and they all do it in their own individual way because there hasn't been any big market trend to jump on this and try to capitalize on it really. Like, you know, with guitars, for example, there's so many things with like software, you know, these like plugins that you can use to sort of like simulate or emulate your favorite players, all these sort of extended range instruments and these different lines and signature models. And like, there's just so much out there. And, you know, I think that it's, of course, it's cool that that exists, but it's a double-edged sword because now you see that that market is so oversaturated because so many people can sound like their favorite player that they do. And then it makes it a little bit less special because it turns into this kind of fashion trend as opposed to everyone making their own artistic statement in an organic way of their own accord. So I have mixed feelings about it, but I think that with cello or violin or viola, you know, it's like it would be cool maybe to see a little bit more of like a move towards maybe, I don't know, maybe like a new line of electric instruments or like some pedals that are customized, like optimized for Bode strings.
You should really talk to Tracy because he does all that. But his friend Mark Wood, do you know Wood Violins? For years in the international musician, if you're a union member, there would be like Mark with his Viper violin. I remember the... Yeah, so he's going to be on this podcast soon. Yet. And I know that they have... Nice. They customize electric cellos, and I know they have a five-string cello. I think they call it a Coda or something. And it's Cobra, or something, yeah.
Oh, the Cobra, right. I remember seeing that. Yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah, I've definitely seen those. Again, it's like you can't go to like Long and McQuaid or a Guitar Center and find one though. So it's like you really have to know those people and then kind of try it out. I've heard Vio Electra makes good electric cellos. I've never tried one, but apparently they sound good. I have a friend that has one and sounds great on it. So I would be interested in maybe kind of going that route, but it's always I feel like there's a lot left for me to just do with the gear that I have.
I was curious about just still trying touring to, though, because you're touring with Leprous. It's a heavy metal band. I mean, that's expensive to be shipping your... Do you buy a seat for your cello every time? How does that...
At the beginning we were using that cello, and that was part of the expense of having me out there, was the cello seat. I did a few tours with the Schreyer cello, and then I think, it was the 2020 tour where, like, we had a lot of flights. And so when you're flying so much within the tour, then you need to be checking instruments. Like, you can't, you know, for example, if you don't have a tour bus that you can just bring stuff into, you know, you have a trailer and everything and you're just driving, then all of a sudden you have to just go carry on, basically, and then... like minimal gear that you would check on the plane. And so that's when I started using the carbon fiber cello. I used it for that tour, and I have the double case and I just check it. And then actually all the other stuff I've done live with them since has been with that cello. And it's useful because for these kind of one-off festivals and things where it's really touch and go, and like, you know, we're just kind of dragging like all of these things around and we don't have the luxury of a vehicle. It's extremely helpful. But also, I was going to say, like, when you tour in the States in particular, there's such a wide range of climates that, like, if you're going to put your instrument in the trailer and then you're driving through all these places and you might have like a 9-hour drive where the weather changes a lot, then at least, you know, when you take it out, it's going to be the same. And then my bow actually travels in the vehicle in a bow case. So that carbon fiber cello can kind of handle all of that stuff, basically. We did this show in France at Hellfest, and it was like 40 degrees out. And, you know, when you play outdoors in 40-degree weather, it's like, you bring that cello. I still use a wood bow, but, I don't really think that carbon fiber bows are really on the level in the same way. Like, I think they just don't have they don't produce the overtones. Like, the sound just, they're okay. Like, they sound clean, but it's like you don't get that same frequency range. It just can't produce that. So, anyway, that's, in terms of gear,
You talked a little bit about perfectionism. You touched on it. And I think a lot of musicians, we have that streak, but especially string players, because we always have to think about playing in tune, and you play super well in tune. So I'm curious, like, you know, you're an improviser, you've been improvising from a young age, so that like frees you up from the perfectionistic streak, you know, and you play it. So how do you think that affects you as an artist?
That's interesting. In terms of improvising, I think that it just makes me feel that having my own creative agency and sort of jumping in there and doing something a bit unknown feels in a way actually more secure, because I can create it as I go. And I think it's like the combination of being secure on the instrument, knowing your way around the instrument, and then being able to kind of, you can control the rules of the game a little bit when you improvise. I mean, to varying degrees, like when you play with different people, then you don't always have the same amount of musical affinity with them, and that depends on the person a lot, but you can at least kind of feel secure in your sound and the way you approach your instrument. You know, the tuning thing, to be honest, yeah, it's like something I think about all the time, because it's like the instrument doesn't really speak, you know, fully, right? It doesn't really resonate fully when we don't play in tune. So, like, I think what it really hit me was when I started recording cello, like, on records. And the first time, actually, I think was, well, I had done some kind of session work in high school, but then I did some stuff of my own, and I had this composition, and it was like a 5 cello, you know, layered thing. And I had never done that before, but I had all of a sudden wanted to do it, you know, and it was only at that moment that I realized, like, oh, okay, these layers have to stack up in a certain way, and it's like this kind of puzzle, and to intonate these chords and everything so that they all feel good, like, you have to be super aware of, like, centering everything, but also understanding, like, the type of tuning system you're using and how you're gonna, like, make all of that add up. And I got really obsessed with it in a way. Like, so I was doing so much session work, and a lot of it was layering. A lot of it was like, it started off with more like 4-part harmonies, and then it got to like 8, 9, 10 layers, you know, and depending on the project, it would get really dense. And so I just got a lot of experience doing that. I would say playing on other people's records and my own, but just having so much experience in the studio and having to kind of deliver results made me think a lot about how the left hand especially operates, and like, why do things sound the way they do, and like, just you start kind of analyzing the behavior of the left hand a lot, and you know, when do you vibrate and how much, and should you really vibrate, you know, on certain things. Like, so yeah, those are all things that I thought about a lot, and so I think it just kind of, it adds up. But, and then I guess in an improvised setting, then it's like, that makes it easier to play something for the first time as though it's like the red button was on and you were recording, and like, you're going to play it as though it was the actual thing that would end up being put on the record. Does that answer your question? I mean, it's kind of, I guess, my experience of it, really. But I feel like improvisation is something that, like, I've done kind of forever. And I was lucky to get to play with people also and, like, kind of jam with people from a very young age, and feel like it was okay, you know, and that what I was doing was okay. And there was never this feeling of, oh, I don't know what to do, or I'm not doing the right thing. I always kind of had this feeling of, I'm doing the right thing, or the thing that feels cool to me at that time. And maybe, you know, when I was really young, it was terrible, but I didn't feel that way. You know what I mean? I felt like it was, exciting and good. So, I just sort of, always felt at home with it. And I think, like, hearing something and then responding to it with what makes sense musically always felt better to me than reading off of a page and trying to make sure that I got all the details on the page. Like, I'm the type of person where I can walk into a room and if it's in my own house, for example, like, just not notice stuff. So like I won't notice that there was something like dirty, you know, for a really long time, and I just not pay attention to it. So it's like, you know, on a sheet, like a sheet of music, it's like, you might not pick up on that detail. It's only experience that teaches you, okay, like, you have to like scan all the details and kind of see that stuff in advance, because it's going to bite you later, you know, and someone else might notice it. So then it's like, you're going to play differently from them. But also that aspect of playing differently is something that I always kind of held on to. I always embraced that. I always thought, well, like, I want to play differently from other people. I don't want to play the same way as them. So I'm going to lean into that, you know? So even as I got more comfortable, like, playing in group settings and like an orchestra and chamber music, I always had this feeling of, yeah, but I'm going to kind of like bring a bit of myself in there and have a bit of attitude as well. So that's something that never really left, you know. It was just, I always wanted to bring that personality, regardless of the music. Of course, the music is going to change what you bring to the table, but it just felt more right to me somehow. And I think that when you watch a concert, for example, you watch exciting players, it's like something that makes it exciting is that you can see their personalities. It's like they're at a table having a conversation. And like if you're watching a movie, you know, if it's a really good script, then and the actors are good, then you should get a sense of each person's character within that one scene. And you're already getting an idea of like where they each come from and how they would respond to a certain question or whatever.
I think that's where small ensembles differ from large ensembles. Yeah.
Agreed. 100%. 100%. Yeah. And actually, to bring it back to recording, like, that's also why, like, when I do really layered stuff, I barely vibrate. And, like, I don't play most of the parts with much character at all, really. And then maybe if there's like a top part that you know is going to stick out, or but even then, maybe it's just all about the blend. And it's totally contextual. You're 100% right, of course. But I think part of why I think improvisation has appealed to me in that way is because there's like that feeling of like each person kind of being sort of their own personality. And it's the way those personalities interact, or if there's one person on stage, then it's really about their voice, actually. Mm-hmm.
And when you play with Leprous, from what I understand, you have more of a supporting role.
It's mixed. Like, we're all sort of... I think that in that group, like, every person in the band has their opportunity to shine because of the compositions. And I think that it's like... when you play with a singer, then of course it's like, I mean, that's what most people are going to focus on probably, is the singer and the lyrics, or just the focus of there being a front person on stage, or, you know, whatever. But it's the type of music also that, because it's like very dynamic and progressive, which is a funny term, but there's a lot of like a lot of musical interest happening throughout all of the instruments and throughout the pieces. There's a lot that you can pay attention to. It's not like, you know, for example, some mixes, it's like you have a main part and then everything else feels a little bit like it's really being pushed down and sort of like compressed together. And you can't necessarily discern all the details, but here it's like there's a lot of ear candy and your attention is being drawn in different places. And I think that there's moments where like the cello is operating more like it's creating an orchestral texture. Yeah. And there's other places where it's playing a lead, and there's other places where, especially in the live setting, not so much in the records, but like live, sometimes I'll play the same thing as the guitar or the bass, and like double or do things that are more kind of texture oriented, like kind of sound effects and using pedals and stuff like that. And that's also what I like about the shows, is that there's a lot of room within the pieces to add extra kind of Easter eggs and improvise a little bit within certain sections and not play the same thing, but it's like you're kind of just decorating parts. And then there's other parts where you really commit and you have to kind of play very specifically. That's something about that group, actually, that's kind of interesting, is because we play with in-ear monitors and we play with a click track, and there's like backing tracks and stuff, and there's a lot going on, and everybody in that band is a very good musician, like exceptionally good musician. So like when you play the songs, you have to play really tight. And again, yeah, the issue of like playing in tune is a huge thing, and sort of getting everything to line up in a certain way so the ensemble feels cohesive. So when you're hearing things in that level of detail, almost like you're in a studio, then I remember like for a while it was a bit nerve-wracking because I was so focused on trying to lock in that way and, you know, make sure that everything worked. But over time, I feel that like it's better to kind of just sort of let go more and allow it to happen. I mean, if you know the material and you've been playing it, of course it's easier, but like... just to sort of sink into it a bit more, because usually it turns out better. This feeling of like of course, in a way, you are being a surgeon. You're trying to, like, okay, can I, like, get all of these really difficult shifts in tune over this thing that's happening while standing up? And there's, like, all this stuff going on. You know, it can feel a little bit overwhelming, but it's also, like, better to just sort of have this easy feeling in the body and just, like, let it happen.
Standing up? Cello?
You're yeah, often playing standing with them.
Like a really long
yeah,
end so pin? Because, like, you're a tall guy.
Yeah. I just make it a longer end pin, and then because sometimes I walk around a little bit and play. So, and increasingly we're playing on bigger stages too, where it's like you kind of need to occupy that space. It depends. Like some things, I never tried to play them standing because I think that it would be too difficult. But I do enjoy it a lot, and I actually feel like as a cellist, like it does release some tension to stand. And this feeling of sitting and like your body's kind of compressed, any nerves that you're feeling already kind of get a bit amplified, or like they have nowhere to really disperse. It's a lot harder. Whereas like when you're standing, you have this feeling that you can kind of just let that go a bit more. And so I kind of like that in a way. There's a bit more freedom. You don't feel like you're kind of like in your little box, and then you're stuck there, you know.
When I was reading about electric cellos, I'm not trying to convince you or anything, I was just curious about it, that they're self-supporting some of them, so that you don't have to hold it, and you can stand, and they're smaller, I guess,
For sure.
I'm curious about this click track. Is this common for rock bands that you perform with a click track?
Yeah, it's more and more that way. I would say, like, with heavy music, you know, so anything that's sort of metal-oriented, it's definitely a thing, because I think part of it is that a lot of that music is written on the computer. And so there can be some very anal tempo changes happening, you know, that are very specific. And certain things, especially extreme metal, like a lot of death metal and stuff, where the drumming in particular is very physical and requires like this, it's super crazy precision, you know. If you had it too fast or too slow, it kind of wouldn't really work. Like it would be difficult to play, actually. So it's like the tempo has to be very specific. So in a lot of those kind of very technical styles, I think it helps the bands play better together. But I think it's also just that using in-ear monitors, of course, gives you a better sense of what's happening. But then like having the click track just kind of gives you this reference that you lock onto. And I think and the last part is just very clear. It's the backing tracks. Like a lot of bands have tracks. It's very practical if someone can't be there, if something just happens and someone can't be on stage. Like, for example, our bass player couldn't make the last like few shows of our last tour, but we were able to record the last show that he played and just play those songs. So actually the audience was hearing his bass performance live, but on a track. And of course then it would be the same every time, and we'd be, you know, we would be together with it. So it's very common. You know, it's funny, I don't see a lot of bands in the region. In fact, I don't know if I can think of any bands in the Ottawa region that I know of that really use in-ears. But like in Europe it's very common, and in the States to a degree as well. Like I think if you're playing that type of music, for sure. But certainly like in pop, you know, I think everyone's using in-ears. Like, wedges are just kind of horrible. Like, you know, I've had a lot of varied experiences. I like the feeling of the air moving on stage, and I like, you know, I kind of like that feeling of the sound being loud, but it's also like you don't really have the level of clarity. So it's like you could be hearing something, and then actually it sounds entirely different in the PA, and it's just you're getting this speaker just kind of blasting stuff at you. And even like that last show that I did at Redbird the other week, it was like actually the wedges ended up being way too loud, and it was like it was really harsh. You know, I wanted some high end, but there was just too much high end, and it was really hard on my ears actually. So like in general, like the in-ears do save you that a little bit, but then also you have a lot of sound directly in your ear canal. So you have to be able to somehow balance that so that it feels like it's not overwhelming when
I was going to ask you about hearing damage. Do you think you've suffered from any?
Oh, definitely, definitely. Yeah, I'm sure I have lots. Like,
yeah.
You know, I have crazy loud tinnitus, like crazy. And I think it's also, it's partly a result of playing a bowed string instrument because like it produces a lot of overtones, a lot of high end information already. And then when you play it amplified, you get even more, you know, you get, because any added gain is going to add all these new frequencies to the sound. And a lot of it even comes from recording, actually. I would say it probably doesn't come from attending shows at all. It's probably exclusively from recording and playing shows. Yeah, it's, I kind of think it comes with the territory a little bit, but I'm pretty conscious of like just not giving my ears too much like information on days when I don't have to work. You know, if I'm listening to music, it's like, I don't need to blast music when I'm just listening, and like I might not go to a show that I don't want to go to, or I'm definitely going to wear these to the show because it would just be a stupid place to get more hearing damage, you know. So that's kind of how it is for me, I guess. I mean, I'll be honest, I like hearing things loudly when I'm actually playing. I think we all do, because it's like you kind of get more into it. It's hard when it's turned all the way down to feel like you can sort of commit to what you're playing in the same way. It kind of feels like, oh, it's so distant. And then you have to sort of play cautiously. It's tricky. It's tricky. But it's something that I think about pretty much daily now. So, yeah, I'm definitely cautious, I guess. But sometimes things happen and then you think like, oh, it wasn't so bad, but it still kind of affects you. Yeah, hearing damage is real, and it's not something to make fun of. It's cool to have your hearing, and it's totally
most,
okay
most
to
musicians
wear earplugs
have some level of
stuff.
Hearing damage.
So
well, talking about health, like you're a high energy guy, and you know you tour a lot. What do you do, like, in terms of physical and mental health? Do you go for runs? Do you meditate? What kind of stuff?
Yeah, I do exercise. Not as much as I would like, but I stay active. I think that ideally, like, you know, people talk about having like coffee in the morning. Mm-hmm. For me, like, the best way to start a day is to get some type of exercise, whether it's like, running or going for a bike ride or like some like calisthenics or, you know, something like that. That stuff definitely just sort of, it changes your whole approach to the day also and your energy level. When you're traveling, it can be really hard to do that. Although like on tour, it's possible if you just kind of force it to happen when you have like even a half an hour or something. The guys in Leprous, most of those guys are really good at that. Actually, they're really good at like, taking time to like exercise in their respective ways. Like they all have different routines and things they do. Also just walking is really good. And like I walk a lot, and like it's just generally good for the mind as well. I feel like we spend so much of the day with like mental chatter and just all this stuff going on, and especially when you're online, then like you really get in your own head more. And so then the voice in your head kind of gets louder, and it's hard to kind of be connected back with your body, which ultimately I think makes you more like in the present moment, I guess, and able to like do things in the real world. It's like your nervous system kind of gets a bit scrambled sometimes. I find for me that's sort of how it is with the internet. So yeah, but I find that walking is like one of the best things for that, because you have the time to take in your surroundings. You're not just focusing on the, you know, sustaining the exercise, but you could go for a long time, and gradually like it kind of clears your head a lot. So for me, that's really important. I would say, like exercise, and then also just like good eating habits and not eating weird things, you know. And for me, it's always been very easy to not eat crap, you know. But then on the road too, it's like one thing that actually touring made me do is just to stop drinking alcohol. I realized like alcohol doesn't make me feel good, especially the next day, you know. And it makes it especially hard when you're traveling and you're living in a moving vehicle. And so maybe just why do that? You know, of course, moderation is fine, but I just kind of feel like I don't need that. So for me, like I don't do alcohol, I don't do coffee, you know, and that makes functioning a lot easier, especially I find like, yeah, those types of things don't actually go well with like lack of sleep, you know, and lack of sleep is a big part of this job, especially the traveling part, you know, doing festivals and I mean, even touring to an extent, like often you're just, you don't get good sleep, you know, it's like kind of fragmented and sometimes you're flying or you have to, you know, you're on a weird schedule or jet lag or whatever. So then being able to save energy and function well, even if you've had a minimal amount of sleep, is really important. So it's not easy, but you get used to it, I guess, and you understand your own patterns. Like I understand also when my mood changes, I realize it's because of that, and that I need to just sort of like take some space and you know, so that's, yeah, I don't know. I try to come up with strategies to handle those
and,
things well.
Do you, like, to manage, we talked a little bit about promotion and stuff. Do you compartmentalize, like, because the internet can be, like you're saying, like with notifications and responding to fans and all that. How do you manage that so it doesn't get too much into your day?
I would say the best way, I don't always manage it well. I'm just going to be honest about that.
Yeah.
But what I tend to do is, like, if I want to get something good done, it's going to get done early in the day.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, of course, you can put in good hours later, but they're not as good.
Mm-hmm.
For me, they're never as good. So being able to start something important, like, basically in, you know, 2 or 3 hours before noon in the day, that's essential. So basically, if I don't engage with my email or with the social media, and I don't, like, it's difficult sometimes because you think, oh, you know, I should really think about what I'm gonna post here, or like, what would be the right thing today, or like, should I wait, or like, oh, there's this person that, you know, is waiting for me to reply. Like, of course, there's always these things that are pulling at you, but if you take the time for yourself, I find that, like, your day goes dramatically better. If you know, so for me, like, if I get those things done before noon, something, even just putting a dent in something, then I can go into the abyss of the internet and feel like, you know, my day isn't kind of getting sucked away like super fast. So the early hours are really important, like just getting some of the good work done, ideally as much as possible. But like, I try to be gentle with myself and go like, okay, you did a little bit there, you know, that's good. And because that's a good habit, you know, and I think it's important to reward good habits and to not just feel like, oh, I'm never getting enough done type thing, which is an easy feeling to have, that you're like, nowadays we feel somehow, I think it's this weird societal pressure to be productive. And I don't think that like previous maybe generations of people felt that same need. Mm-hmm. I think it's like, it's a constructed thing, as I'm sure like in previous generations, there were other, you know, things that society constructed for us that were totally in our heads that didn't really exist, you know, in any tangible way, but we all just believed them. So productivity is one of them for sure, where it's like, I think it's a very American idea too, of like sort of your efficiency over time and like how much you can get done. But, I mean, quantity is important, I think, in the sense of consistency, but quality is something that not everyone can deliver. And like, if you can deliver something with quality, then it makes what you do much more valuable. And it's not only to other people, but it's also like, I think that having a practice of making something in a way that has quality, that's like, that's something that you can kind of, it's like a meditation, you know, like I find when I record, that I'm really slow, you know, I take a lot of time and like I'm probably much slower than other people that do the same type of work, but when I finish, like I go, okay, I couldn't have done this better, you know, and then I deliver the files and it's like, okay, I know that I did it to the best of my ability, and that's just the way I want to work now. I don't want to settle for less than that. Like, and I take pride in that. You know, it's like a craftsman or someone. It's like maybe they, like a luthier, let's say. Like luthiers are kind of like this, I think, where they take a lot of pride in their work. And I understand why, because it's a special and unique art. And like they spend a lot of time working on an instrument and making it something that someone else can live with for a long time. And, you know, that's a special thing. And to be able to have that power to, you know, take like just wood basically and turn it into this thing that can produce music, like that's, you know, that's a kind of magic in a way. And of course creating music is like that too. So I think, yeah, that craftsmanship and like sort of taking pride in your work and being able to enjoy the slow process and you know, not feel like it just needs to get done at a certain time because you're on the clock, but to understand your own rhythm and then to arrive at a result that satisfies you. Like for me, that's really important. And so, yeah, I think that like sometimes people expect everything very quickly, I think, especially nowadays, but being able to work at a pace that feels true to you is important as well. And that can be hard because you have to distance yourself from the pressure of, well, hey, why haven't you done this thing? And like, it's like, well, sometimes it just takes the time that it takes. And, you know, that's all there is to it.
Part two of this episode will be released 1 week after the release of this first part. It's a bit shorter and has more music and includes some interesting background on Raf's development as a musician. He also shares his advice on building relationships in the music business to help artists find different avenues to promote their music. He speaks about improvisation, his love of Middle Eastern music, and his collaboration with Shahryar, Jamshidi, and Kamanchelo. My life is so enriched by getting to know all these fascinating musicians on this series. Please check out more of these episodes. I speak with a diverse range of musicians following different career and creative paths. All these episodes are available in both video and podcast format. Everything is linked in the description of the episode to my website, leahroseman.com.